Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with three lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
We get it. Attention spans just aren't what they used to be. Heads in social media and eyes on Netflix. But what do people do with their ears? Well, for one, they're listening to audio. Americans spend 4.4 hours with audio every day. Oh, and you want the proof? Well, you just sat through this ad that's now approaching 30 seconds. What could you say to a potential customer in 30 seconds? Let Odyssey put together a media plan tailor-made for your unique marketing needs. Advertise with Odyssey. Visit ads.odyssey.com.
I just had records and physical media, cassettes, everything since I was a kid, and I just never gave up any of them.
In an age where music is seemingly just in thin air, there's still something enthralling about hearing that same music on vinyl.
It's kind of an unexplainable thing. Like, you can't totally put your finger on why it's special, why it means something to you, but you can hear it. You know, the discerning ear can hear it.
But what ties does Chicago have to the record biz, both past and present? And why do these wax circles continue to speak so much to the circle of existence?
There's a quote from John Peel, and he said, "Life has surface noise." And doesn't it?
I'm Jim Hanke, and this week we examine just a few of the ways our city has influenced the record industry and how vinyl has influenced the lives of some area residents. Dust off your turntable and let's get looped in, Chicago.
We had cassette tapes and stuff like that from like every Bruce Springsteen concert, you know, the bootleg.
Yeah,
he had all that stuff. So that was fun to find. There was, I think, 1 through 4 of Led Zeppelin's albums. And as a teenager, that's the best. That's what you hope your dad was listening to, you know?
This is 25-year-old Uptown resident Alphonse Joseph Niedermeyer IV. Don't let that weighty intro fool you. He's about as laid back as they come.
I mean, I just can't believe they gave 4 people that name. Like, it's a mouthful.
With a birth name like Alphonse, I was convinced this New Jersey native must have a deep Italian bloodline. But he says all the Alphonses before him...
It's funny. They all want to be Italian. They all married Italians, but it's a German name. They're out on Long Island, and so everybody's got the Italian accent.
Yes.
Nobody directly related to me is Italian.
And per request, he's known to most everyone as AJ.
That was actually a compromise that my parents made. My mom said he can be Alphonse, but he's going to be AJ. And my dad was like, as long as it's on the birth certificate, you know?
I wanted to talk with AJ because he had a unique story on how he inherited a record collection, specifically his dad's.
Yeah, he was a Port Authority cop, and he was on, I think, traffic duty. And he got called in to go to the South Tower.
Alphonse Joseph Niedermeyer III served with the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey Police Department for 17 years. In 1992, he received a citation for rescuing passengers from a U.S. Airways jet that skidded off a runway at LaGuardia Airport. On September 11th, 2001, he was last seen rushing into the World Trade Center to rescue trapped victims in the South Tower. AJ was 2.5 at the time, and his mom was pregnant with his sister, who was born in May 2002.
There are things that, at this point, it almost feels like I remember, but, you know, it's stories, it's pictures. but I wouldn't say that I have my own memories. I definitely was always looking for something to connect to. You know, I was always looking to try and understand more of who he was. And I think there was sort of an image problem that I got frustrated with. You know, I had some friends who were in similar situations, and I know it was a thing for all of us. Like, you hear a narrative and you don't necessarily get a lot of exposure to the person you're trying to understand.
So AJ says once he got old enough to play them on his own, it was through his dad's records that he finally began to feel a real connection to the man he barely got to know, especially when it came to another Jersey boy, the aforementioned Bruce Springsteen.
I remember, obviously, Born to Run and Darkness on the Edge of Town. Those are the two big ones that I played a lot. A lot of Bruce Springsteen songs were, wow, I feel like I'm learning something about the person. I loved Cover Me. I think, you know, that hit for different reasons. That hit kind of because of what had happened. I think the songs that stood out to me were the ones that were putting out a little bit of the same kind of angst as I was feeling. And I think, you know, I could tell which he had listened to the most. And so I could tell, and that's another cool thing about vinyl, is you have the wear and tear, you can see it. And it's like you're almost having a conversation a little bit.
Even if your record collection has gone unplayed in your basement or a storage locker for decades, vinyl as a way to hear music has never fully went away. Small independent labels kept releasing 45s and LPs during the height of compact discs. And now that CDs are becoming harder to find and to play in the shadow of digital streaming and downloads, vinyl has spun back around. For 17 straight years, in fact, vinyl sales globally have been increasing year over year. And for two straight years, vinyl has eclipsed CDs as the number one physical format in the world. Last year alone, according to the Recording Industry Association of America, people bought 43 million vinyl records, a format that the world's biggest music stars like Beyoncé and Taylor Swift have completely embraced, introducing a new generation to the joys of dropping the needle. Record Store Day is this coming Saturday, April 20th. It's a national event intended to celebrate your local neighborhood music merchant. If you have a record store in your area, you may see a line out the door on Saturday as vinyl lovers pick up new, exclusive, limited releases on wax from the likes of U2, Willie Nelson, David Bowie, and the Ramones. Chicago is blessed to be home to a vibrant and diverse network of independently owned record stores. But before records arrive in stores, they have to be pressed. And the next new album you buy might have been made, front to back, right here in Chicago. Steve Politnik is a co-founder of Smash Plastic Record Pressing. Their plant is about 10,000 square feet, located in the old Hammond Organ Factory on the corner of Diversey and Tripp. Here, huge machines whir, and punk rock blares from turntables as that same album is getting stamped in real time. He admits, the way vinyl's trajectory has gone since the early 2000s, he thought someone else would have beaten them to the punch.
It's crazy that a market as big as Chicago and a music scene as vast and diverse as the Chicago music scene didn't have a pressing plant. So we thought someone was always 6 months, a year ahead of us, until we opened.
That opening was in 2019, and on any given day, their staff is manufacturing maybe 10 or 20,000 records for large bands and more modest runs of 250 for smaller acts. Steve says at first, although the majority of their work was for local projects, they were rather location agnostic, taking orders from anywhere on the globe.
But once the pandemic really hit, we saw plants just really starting backing up. We said, we shouldn't be taking a job for a client in LA to the detriment of a client here in Chicago. And we wanted to make sure that we took care of the Chicago market. It was important to us because it's a vast and diverse music scene that should be cultivated. And allowing a client here or a band here to get their records out over a band in LA or Nashville or wherever else, it was important to us. And we want to still be a part of that music scene. Can we take business outside of Chicago? Yes, or Illinois. But our focus always is and always will be Chicago first.
You can catch video of my tour of Smash Plastic on our socials, located in the show notes for today's episode. And during my visit, Steve told me that aside from maybe a touchscreen or some sensors, not much has changed on how a record pressing machine from the 1940s works 80 years later. Despite it being automated, it's a slow process, and it still has to be supervised and run by humans.
Filling the hopper to make sure that there's enough PVC, the correct PVC, to label alignment, to making sure the records are coming off looking clean, and we're listening. We're quality control throughout the process. We're grabbing records off the spindles as they get pressed to make sure we're listening and they're sounding good, looking good. It's a very hands-on process.
Steve also says the same COVID lockdown that made them focus on Chicago artists also increased people's general curiosity about starting or revisiting their record collections.
We had a huge spike in sales kind of across the board. I had multiple friends, family members that said, we're starting to dip their toes back into vinyl and what turntable should I get? Kind of setup should I do? Recommending records and things like that. So I think a lot of people really dove into vinyl. And I think it's flattened out now. People can go to shows. You can support, that was the way you could support a band. And now you can go see a show. You can do other ways to support bands. Obviously, I prefer they buy the vinyl.
You could argue that having access to Smash Plastic in one's own backyard has turned some local musicians into moguls of their own niche market.
Did you watch the Beatles Get Back documentary?
I've known musician and songwriter Evan Weiss for a while. He's a Philadelphia transplant and has lived in Chicago since 2008.
So there's a scene in the third episode. They're going through songs that they want to play on the rooftop. And they're like, oh, it'd be cool. Let's do Need Mr. Mustard or whatever. And there's a scene where they're like, they don't really remember how it goes. They have to call someone in to bring in a turntable and a copy of the record so they can listen to the record and remember how the song goes. That blew my fucking mind. It was like, oh my God, yeah, it's the 60s and you have no other way to listen to your music and reference it and figure out how it was done. It's so easy now. Oh, how's that song go? Fucking pull your phone out and type a couple words in. You can fire it up and learn it or listen to it. No, they had to cart in a turntable and a copy of Abbey Road and remember how to do this fucking song.
Evan has released an incalculable amount of vinyl over the years as a member of bands like Into It Over It, There, Pet Symmetry, and more. And that's not including releasing records for friends or reissuing the occasional long out-of-print album by some of his heroes. He has an envy-inducing record collection, to say the least, and currently he's got a vinyl subscription service going through his own independent record label, Storm Chasers Limited. If you subscribe, you can score a very limited album once a month, and Evan has Smash Plastic press them up. Now, considering how much vinyl Evan has had his name on, in one form or another, over almost 25 years, I asked him how essential it is to have a company like Smash Plastic just down the block.
Oh my God, dude, we can't do what we do without it. So much of the costs accrued in the vinyl manufacturing process are actually the shipping, not the manufacturing. We basically have been able to cut out shipping costs completely. It also allows us to be incredibly nimble because this record that is coming out in a month, we have it already. So I've already been able to ship copies to retail. I've already been able to get copies in the hands of friends and the band, all the marketing resources taken care of. Or in some instances, we get copies of a record and are able to put it on sale the same day that we pick it up. Cool. They're here. It's on sale. Go get it.
And Smash Plastic's proximity doesn't just help Evan's bottom line in an era where physical music is still very much for a specific audience. He recognizes his efforts are contributing to the livelihoods of real people.
The money that we're spending is supporting the local economy. I know the people who are operating the presses personally. These are folks that are friends and, in some cases, the former pressing plant manager was the husband of one of my coworkers. I know that money that they made from working at that plant, which partially came from me, helped fund their wedding, And so it's stuff like that just feels a little more, shop local, small business, keeping it in the city, making sure that we're supporting each other and what we're doing. And Smash is actually really aware of that. But yeah, had we had to get records shipped all around the world or get here to do what we're doing, we could never afford it. It would actually be financially impossible for us to do this.
Speaking of Evan's mention of the Beatles having to cart in a record player to relearn their own music, it's worth noting that the black-owned Chicago record label VJ launched in 1953 by the husband and wife team of Vivian Carter and James Bracken was the first American label to ever release Beatles music. And unless you're a diehard music fan, you might not know that Chicago, for a time, was a perennial hotbed for the record biz.
It's so crazy to think about, but within, you know, like a few blocks distance, you had all these heavy hitter labels. BJ, Chess, Curtum, Brunswick, I think was located there. Some of these artists I interviewed, they're like, yeah, we just go shop our demos around and just go walk down those couple blocks there. Not too far from, you know, where we are right now, I guess.
That is Steve Krakow. And long after the Beatles' first single on VJ, he recounted with me his deep dive into the later period of the band.
I remember going to the library, getting the White Album, and, you know, becoming sort of aware that, oh, this is like a greater piece, you know? This is like a concept or something. I could tell there was more at work there. Probably the first time I heard, like, experimental music, too, you know, Revolution No. 9 and stuff.
Steve followed that psychedelic itch and makes music himself under the moniker Plastic Crime Wave. But for almost 20 years now, his passion for telling the untold stories of lesser-known artists has manifested in his column, The Secret History of Chicago Music, which you can find bi-weekly in the Chicago Reader. And like vinyl, Steve's articles are super tactile. Hand-drawn and handwritten by the author, these vignettes almost resemble collectible trading cards, and in a short amount of print space, give you the most crucial information on not-so-household names, like Elgin blues rocker's Iron Lung, or Benny Turner, who was forever in his famous guitar-slinging brother Freddie King's shadow. I asked Steve what drives him to tell and draw these little-known true-life tales.
Yeah, you know, some artists, it's like you hear it and you're like, okay, this was really obscure for a reason. You hear it and you're like, this is some out-there stuff. And then you hear something and you're like, wow, why was this not on the charts? And you're like, oh, bad manager. Bad life circumstances, they had a family, like whatever, and you're just like, wow, this music really deserves to be heard, you know, as much as something celebrate, or, you know, even we're talking about Syl Johnson, it's like, how many people know Talking Heads, Take Me to the River? How many people know that's by Syl Johnson, you know, that song? So it's like, it's important to shed a light on these artists, and also so they don't get ripped off by the industry, because a lot of them did their entire lives, and that's another wrong to correct by, like, reissuing these albums correctly and making sure the artists get paid, and from what I understand, Numero is really good about that.
Ask any record collector, especially locally, about who's releasing some truly impactful vinyl these days, and one name will keep coming up, the Numero Group. Located on South Troy Street in Little Village, Numero's current building was completed in 1919, and then housed the Success Bottling Company during Prohibition's soda boom years. As a vinyl lover myself, I can't overstate that this local record label, started by Ken Shipley and Rob Sevier in 2003, has literally given a second life to countless musicians over the last few decades, including, as Steve mentioned, the great Syl Johnson. Painting with a wide brush, Numero is a boutique reissue label, meaning they don't sign any new bands, really. Their primary mission is to find, spotlight, and give a new audience to forgotten gems in genres like R&B, gospel, and garage rock. Here's Steve with more of the Numero story.
It seems like they would track down the entire tapes of a label, you know, like a small soul label, and just clean it all out and be like, what's in here and what's in the tapes, and put out this stuff that was top tier, but then also dig deeper and find these sort of unreleased things that had never even seen the light of day. You know, they've of course delved into some local labels as well, like Twinite, the comps they did of the Twinite stuff, which sort of birthed them doing this huge box set on Syl Johnson, who was on that label, which got a Grammy nomination, if I'm not mistaken. So it's, you know, I feel like it's been a sort of organic process. But yeah, I mean, they're definitely Chicago artists. There's this incredible soul guy that still performs Ronaldo Domino, and he's on the cover of one of those Twilight comps wearing like a velvet purple suit, looking like the coolest guy who ever walked the planet. And you're like, what's that? They've done psychedelic stuff, weird new age private presses, poetry records, and stumbled on things that they didn't even think they would find. One of my favorite releases was this psychedelic band from Rockford called Pisces, that they were looking through the tapes of a soul label, and they're like, what's this stuff? You know, and it turns out the guy who ran the studio was like an insomniac who recorded all this like magical mystery tour influence kind of Beatles stuff. You hear it and you're like, whoa, this is like another world. Rockford. This came from Rockford, you know? It's like, what? Mind blown, you know? Like, they're really fighting the good fight. So it's been great to see it, you know, flourish.
Numero presents these albums with a high attention to detail. Super intricate liner notes, incredible never-before-seen photos, more often than not working directly with the artist if they're still alive, and paying the respect that they probably should have gotten in their heyday. But unless something in the audio masters is glaringly amiss, these songs are presented just as they were in the 50s or the 80s or whenever they originally came out. And Steve says, that's part of the mystique and purity of the music.
I mean, soul and like garage rock and stuff especially, how cleaned up do you want it? You know, don't you want a little grit on that? Don't you want to feel like maybe it was one mic hanging in a meat walker when they played? And often it was with these garage bands especially. I guess there's a quote from John Peel and he said, life has surface noise. And doesn't it? If you think about like big garage rock song, Shadows of Night, Gloria, that was on the radio. That's like four tracks, you know, or the Buckingham's kind of a drag. That is like four tracks in a little tiny studio somewhere with probably a couple guys coming out of the same amp, possibly one mic hanging from the ceiling. And it's an eternal hit, you know, forever that nobody will ever, with some glorious mistakes, some glorious scuzz on it. And it's to be celebrated for sure.
The similarity I see between what Numero and Steve do with the label and the column respectively is pretty clear. But Steve says it's not always a slam dunk when convincing these original artists that their work is worth mentioning again in 2024.
I've found that with a lot of these artists I contact for Secret History, some of them are just like, why in the world are you interested in this thing I did, like you said, several lifetimes ago? And then some are thrilled, you know, and some are still doing music. Some of them we continued what they were doing and they're taking it further. You never know. And honestly, I've had a few just almost refuse me because they're just like, my 60s high school garage band is not of interest to anyone. Trust me. And I'm like, no, it really is. I mean, I like a homespun story of kids hanging out in the garage just as much as I like hearing of like, you know, major label hijinks and a behind the music descent. To me, it's just as interesting, you know, like it's a little snapshot of life. And I'm sure Numero feels the same way. You know, this is earnestly created music with no commercial intentions and it's pure, you know.
When we come back, another local storyteller pulls back the curtain on one of Chicago's greatest blues legends. Stay tuned.
Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with three lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
We get it. Attention spans just aren't what they used to be. Heads in social media and eyes on Netflix. But what do people do with their ears? Well, for one, they're listening to audio. Americans spend 4.4 hours with audio every day. Oh, and you want the proof? Well, you just sat through this ad that's now approaching 30 seconds. What could you say to a potential customer in 30 seconds? Let Odyssey put together a media plan tailor-made for your unique marketing needs. Advertise with Odyssey. Visit ads.odyssey.com.
Minnie Riperton is born in Chicago, and she has this insane operatic voice, super crazy range. and she has training early on to be an opera singer, and her teacher is like, you have to go study at the Lyric Opera, like be an opera singer. And she's like, I want to sing soul music. I want to sing rock and roll music. I'm not really interested in opera. So at like 15, she starts this girl group here in Chicago called The Gems.
While Steve Krakow shines a light on lesser known artists by way of a newspaper column, Patrick Hicks is cut from a similar cloth, though the way he provides his expertise is fully steeped in the current social media landscape. Stories like this one, involving Chicago's own two-time Grammy nominee Minnie Riperton, are what has made Patrick somewhat of a viral sensation. Now living in Chicago but having grown up in Southern California, Patrick says neither of his parents could really match his enthusiasm for music, but as a way to connect, his father would fuel Patrick's brain as best he could.
So my dad would go to the library and just get music biographies, but he has no concept of what kind of music I like or anything, so he would just get any music biography. And he'd be like, here's B.B. King, here's Depeche Mode, here's Dolly Parton. I remember specifically reading the Depeche Mode biography before I'd ever heard their music. I know everything about Depeche Mode, and I could not tell you one song, like how it goes. But that's what he would do. Like, that was kind of like his love language, to be like, all right, my son likes music. He still does that. He will send me emails like, have you ever heard of a British band called Oasis? It's like, yeah, Dad, they were pretty famous. I know who they are. So he'll just like send me books still to this day.
Patrick says he's always been creative, but anything in that world, like writing scripts or taking Second City classes, has always been secondary to a full-time job. That, partnered with a wife and kids, caused some creative juices to go stagnant a few years ago. So Patrick's wife challenged him a bit to do something different, to flex those muscles of his that loved music. Patrick then suggested, why don't I make content on TikTok?
We were both kind of like, that's silly. Like, I'm an almost 40-year-old man. But we were obsessed with TikTok because we had these two little kids, so we would be up in the middle of the night. You can't watch a whole show, but, like, you know, you could watch a couple-minute video on TikTok. But then she was like, well, what would you do? What would you do on TikTok? I was like, maybe I would tell music stories. And she was like, okay, yeah, let's see if anybody wants to watch that. And the first couple ones, nobody did.
If you go to Patrick's TikTok or Instagram, linked in the show notes for today's episode, it's frame upon frame of pretty much the same thing. A middle-aged man with a beard and glasses looks directly at you, telling you a little-known story about a well-known artist. These tales about Prince, Bob Dylan, Hank Williams, there is close to no production value in them. But Patrick's way of crafting a narrative has gained him an overwhelming following. Now, he's approaching 500,000 followers on TikTok alone. He's found that the videos that connect the most are ones of determination, where an artist is so insistent on what they're creating that their gumption alone changes their trajectory.
I really don't care if I like the music or not. Everybody has a great story to tell. So yeah, so it was just finding the humanity behind these artists. I mean, especially, you know, back in the 90s and late 80s when I was reading these books, musicians really felt like superheroes. Like, there wasn't all this access that you had. It's like these were untouchable people. So to read their biography or their autobiography, getting a peek behind the curtain and like the origin story, you know, it's like how Spider-Man got bit by a spider. It's like, oh, that's when Keith Richards got his first record. Like, that to me was so mind-blowing.
With this in mind, I asked Patrick to come by our studios to share some uniquely Chicago stories as we prepare for Record Store Day. Are there artists or record labels that are household names that would have not existed if it weren't for our city? A few minutes ago, Patrick began a tale about Minnie Riperton. After a critically acclaimed but modestly selling debut album in 1970, she and her record company began discussing a follow-up.
And she's like, there's only one person I want to produce my album, Stevie Wonder. And they're like, okay, well, Stevie Wonder's like the biggest star in the world right now. He's done like Inner Visions and Talking Book, and like, he's huge. And like, I don't think we can get Stevie Wonder. So they reach out to him, and Stevie Wonder's a big fan. He's like, I'd love to do it. The problem is Stevie's still signed to Motown. So he's like, I can't just go out and produce other records for a different label, but I want to do it. So I'm going to do it, but we're going to use a pseudonym. Stevie produces the album, and the pseudonym that he chooses is El Toro Negro. So that's on like the record. If you look at it, it says like produced by El Toro Negro. Yeah, that's Stevie producing.
Minnie stuck to her guns. She got Stevie, or El Toro Negro, to produce. And that album, Perfect Angel, became Minnie's biggest selling record, giving audiences the tender soul ballad and monster hit, Lovin' You. Now, today, if you pulled Perfect Angel out of a crate at your local record shop, you could easily Google and find out who El Toro Negro was. But imagine in 1974, 50 years ago, when the album dropped. The mystery of that credit could send the mind of a kid sprawled out on his parents' shag carpet in front of the stereo, swirling. And Patrick Hicks is a huge fan of keeping mysteries abound even in the age of instant information. Most of the time in his videos, you don't even know which musician he's referring to until the end. Like for this next tale about a blues legend whose life, before coming to Chicago, was littered with abuse.
Sure. So this is a guy named Chester Arthur Burnett, named after the president. He is born in Mississippi, very poor, you know, very rural area. Chester's mother is like a religious zealot and is kind of mentally unstable and very abusive towards Chester. And at one point when he's a little kid, you know, he's like 8 years old or something, just kicks him out of the house, just tells him he has to leave. And he never really understands why. And he really struggled with this his whole life. You know, he kept trying to reconnect with her even after he becomes successful. He tries to like give her money and she's like, no, you got this from playing the devil's music. I don't want it. So just this horrible relationship. She never, you know, reconnected with him his whole life. And it was very painful to him. So after that, he goes to live with another relative. And this relative was even worse. This relative was super abusive and made him work long hours, took him out of school, wouldn't let him go to school, didn't feed him, you know, beat him, like just all of this horrible stuff. So finally, Chester just runs away. He's like, I can't take it anymore. And he goes to try to find his father and just walks barefoot for like miles across Mississippi until finally he does find his father. It's some crazy story. Like he walked for like, you know, 80 miles or something. He has this kind of glimmer of hope. He gets this little bit of stability. You know, he lives with his father. His father was very loving and he has a little bit of a good childhood. But, you know, hard to erase all the scars from before that. And his father's the one that buys him his first guitar. And he's just in love with the blues. So he's in Mississippi at basically like the birth of the Delta blues, the Mississippi blues, and starts to get kind of a reputation as being like, this is a guy who can sing and play. And then he gets drafted into the army and then just suffers all this horrible abuse in the army too. And just gets stuck with this sadistic drill sergeant who beats him with a riding crop. And the problem is they assign him to like decode communications. That's the assignment he gets. And this is a man who was never allowed to go to school. He can't read. So he's illiterate. And they're like, decode communications. And he can't. So they beat him to the point where he has like a mental breakdown. And so finally he gets an honorable discharge and he gets out of the army. But, you know, he's abused as a kid. He's abused as an adult in the army. All this horrible stuff. Gets into some legal trouble. There's a whole part where he apparently kills a man over a dispute. He had been sleeping with this man's girlfriend, and the man apparently, instead of fighting Chester, he beat up the girlfriend. So Chester went to beat up the man. Chester was like 6'4", 200 and something pounds. He's a really big guy, and apparently cut the man's head off with a gardening tool. So just a crazy life.
As if all this weren't enough to make a best-selling book or emotionally resonating film, Chester's musical reach hadn't even began. He heads to Memphis, home to a truly blossoming blues scene at the time. He runs into a talent scout from Memphis Recording Service. And this scout, who will eventually have a popular duo of his own with future wife Anna Mae Bullock, go ahead and give that a Google, connects Chester with Memphis Recording's head engineer, Sam Phillips, the man who would eventually launch Sun Records and start the careers of Elvis Presley, Johnny Cash, Jerry Lee Lewis, and countless others.
But back then, he didn't have his own label, so what he would do was record the people at his recording studio and then send it to a label. And one of the labels that he had a relationship with was Chess Records here in Chicago. And everybody's like, this is something special. Like, this is going to be huge. And actually, a bidding war breaks out. There's, like, other labels that want it, but Chess Records ends up getting it. And so they release his first kind of big single. And then in 1952, they're like, you're so popular, we want you to move to Chicago. And Chester Burnett, that's not the name on the label. He goes by his nickname, which he'd sort of had since he was a kid. When he was a kid, there's a dispute about how exactly he got this nickname. But as a kid, they start calling him Wolf. That becomes his nickname. And then when he sings, he has this very raspy, very crazy, you know, growly voice. So they start calling him the Howlin' Wolf. Chester Arthur Burnett is Howlin' Wolf. And he comes to Chicago and starts working for Chess. And now is the point where not only is he one of the most important blues artists ever, but changes the course of rock and roll history. I mean, Chess, with him, Muddy Waters, shapes rock and roll.
Though many different cultural influences were at play, Chess gave the Chicago blues a worldwide audience. Hence, when young Brits began hearing it in the early 60s, it led to the start of countless UK bands, including Led Zeppelin, who made a fan out of Alphonse Joseph Niedermeyer III over here in the States. And although he could never share that fandom with his son AJ, how would AJ connect with his dad without it? Here's Patrick again.
Chess Records is started by these two immigrants who came from Poland, Leonard and Phil Chess. They kind of have this entrepreneurial spirit. And so Leonard Chess starts this liquor store on the south side of Chicago in a mostly black neighborhood. And so he starts getting to know black consumers, basically. And, you know, they come in and they're talking about music. And so he starts to become interested in music and what back then they would call race records, so R&B, blues. He opens a club called the Macamba Club, and it's a nightclub that has black musicians. He runs it with his brother Phil. They run it together, and they start to want to get into the record business. And then this is the part of the story I think is so fascinating. Leonard is like a huge poker player, and it's at one of these poker games that he meets this couple, and they're like, oh, we run our own record label called Aristocrat Records. There's a guitar player who's already recording for Aristocrat, Muddy Waters. And so Muddy and Leonard actually become friends, and that shapes a lot of what they bring to Chess and what kind of the vision for Chess is for the world. So the Chess brothers buy out the other couple, and in 1950, they change the name of Aristocrat to Chess Records. And then kind of the first big song they put out as Chess is the Muddy Waters song, Rolling Stone, which, like, could there be a more important song? Like, the Rolling Stones, Rolling Stone magazine, like a Rolling Stone, like, all come from this one song. It's like the first Muddy Waters song on Chess. So that's huge. So then in 1952, they get Howlin' Wolf. And now they've got Howlin' Wolf and Muddy Waters. It's like if you had Magic and Bird on the same team or something. I don't know what a more, you know, current thing is. So these two guys are now in Chicago playing for audiences, and both in their own way, I mean, completely change the course of rock and roll, because as their popularity starts to fade, they get discovered by white kids. The whole British blues boom, Eric Clapton, Jimmy Page, stuff that becomes heavy metal, all of it can be traced back to, you know, these guys who grew up on a farm in Mississippi and stuff. It's insane. When Muddy Waters is playing in the Delta, he's playing acoustic. When you come to Chicago, there's so many people, they're playing these loud, noisy clubs, you can't hear it. So he has to go to electric. And that's really the innovation. That's why they call it the Chicago Blues, is it's electric blues. And the Muddy Waters band is kind of the blueprint of what a rock and roll band is. He had electric guitar, electric bass, drums, you know, maybe some keyboard. That becomes the standard that everybody emulates. So wouldn't have happened without Chicago.
Look, don't let anyone tell you that music is solely an audio medium. If it were, we wouldn't bother with a Super Bowl halftime show, or be transported back to our childhood bedroom whenever we hear the first notes of Let It Be. Songs are equal parts science and magic. You've got the completely explainable, like how a record has got to spin at a certain speed in order to produce sound, meaning the absolutely unexplainable, as in the goosebumps you get when you hear your favorite guitar solo. It's like fact and fiction, or DNA and daydreams, decided to coexist. Science has made streaming music possible, but in a way, the magic end of that equation, even if we try to tell ourselves how amazing it is to get limitless entertainment on our phones, has dwindled. So I pressed my interview subjects this week to make their argument in favor of physical media like vinyl in 2024.
You're opening a can of worms here. You're talking to a guy who just kind of loves clutter.
We'll begin with Steve Krakow.
You know, what's clutter and what's an archive? You know, what's a collection, and, you know, what is hoarding? All these things are very fine lines, but it pains me, you know, not being able to look at the artwork that was painstakingly created. You know, I've just had records and physical media, cassettes, everything since I was a kid, and I just never gave up any of them. You know, like, I stream things on occasion to sort of hear them, but more to be like, am I going to buy this record? That's when I think it's all right. It's just supporting the artist. And a lot of times you're buying a used record, you're not. But I think with especially a current artist, you know, go to their show and buy their record. That's directly helping them in an age when it's hard to get by as a band, you know?
Back with Evan Weiss, it felt maybe a little silly asking him to advocate for the medium that he literally has stacked in his home office, floor to ceiling. But as I mentioned earlier, he's not just a buyer of other people's records or a creator of his own. It seems that one of the benefits of his career is it's allowed him to create magic, bringing things that never existed on vinyl before to life. Like music from the Champaign Urbana 90s group, Very Secretary.
It's a labor of love. Storm Chasers is a break-even operation, but we have people who are very passionately involved and subscribe to our vinyl subscription and are psyched not just to get the records that they want, but they're also excited to hear the stuff that we advocate for. Just a band, like an up-and-coming band from Chicago or New Jersey or anywhere that we just think is badass and wanted to see their record be on vinyl. You know, it's like, I would be lying if I didn't say there was like some selfish desire on my end to see these things exist physically. Like when a record like the Very Secretary record comes out, those are records I wanted to see and I wanted to own and I wanted to listen to on my turntable that didn't exist, and just kind of manifesting them into being. There's always going to be an audience for that. I think there's always an audience for people who are music appreciators who just want to have that tactile experience. It's kind of a unexplainable thing. Like you can't totally put your finger on why it's special, why it means something to you, but like you can hear it. It's a little more prestige. It's a little more special. It's a little more exciting. It feels like you're holding a piece of art. It doesn't feel flimsy or cheap. It's kind of all encompassing of that philosophy, I think. Like if you take pride in your art, wanting to deliver it in a prestigious format.
Steve Polutnik at Smash Plastic, a company that admittedly wouldn't exist if physical media went away, says that teenagers and 20-somethings have definitely fueled vinyl's resurgence. For their whole life, they've had a service like Spotify in their pocket. But there's one thing all that access does not provide. Ownership.
There's something to be said that I own this. Like, I'm supporting that band, I'm supporting that music, pulling the record out and holding it and taking the time, the 20, 25 minutes it takes to sit down and listen to a side and looking at the album artwork. And a thumbnail is not the same thing as holding a 12x12 record jacket and seeing the liner notes and listening to the music in the order that's intended. You know, that is all parts of listening to music. You know, sure, I can pull up a mix, but that's not the order and the feeling that the artists want to put out for you.
And wrapping things up with AJ, I'm brought back to that quote that Steve Krakow laid on us. You don't like static or the skips or the surface noise of vinyl? Hey man, life has surface noise. Some lives more than others.
Especially in a situation like mine where that's what you have, there is a lot of value to it. And the clicks are there because the thing is real. The thing was used and it was meant to be used. You can see there was love, you know, in the music.
This episode of Looped in Chicago was hosted, produced, and edited by me, Jim Hankey, with additional audio by Anne-Marie Welser and Chris Lopez. WBBM's news director is Craig Schwalb, and Myron Kaplan is our managing producer of national news podcasts. You can follow us on TikTok at WBBM News Radio 105.9, as well as on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at WBBM News Radio for visuals related to all of our episodes. Thanks to our hardworking social team of Lauren Westfall, Anne-Marie Welser, and Sarah Digman. And thank you for listening. We'll keep you looped in again right here next week. See you soon.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
We get it. Attention spans just aren't what they used to be. Heads in social media and eyes on Netflix. But what do people do with their ears? Well, for one, they're listening to audio. Americans spend 4.4 hours with audio every day. Oh, and you want the proof? Well, you just sat through this ad that's now approaching 30 seconds. What could you say to a potential customer in 30 seconds? Let Odyssey put together a media plan tailor-made for your unique marketing needs. Advertise with Odyssey. Visit ads.odyssey.com.